Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 2nd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, columnist for Salon.com, proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo, Heather Parton will join us to look back on the week of political news. Also on the program today, Writers Guild of America East Executive Director Lowell Peterson will join us, talk about union organizing and what's happening at MSNBC/The Choice. And AndyKindler.com Executive Director Andy Kindler will be here to tell us why, even as a member of a union, he can't get any work. I'm joking, of course. He's very busy, but he will be here to break down the conservative themes in movies that we all enjoy, surprisingly enough, with help from Ben Shapiro. Meanwhile, U.S. Supreme Court further eviscerates the Voting Rights Act and then takes a hatchet to campaign finance disclosure laws. Trump Organization and Weisselberg indictment includes 15 counts, some of which include federal tax fraud. Federal. As in Department of Justice, federal. Where are they? U.S. economy adds 850,000 new jobs on the heels of nearly 350,000 new unemployment claims. U.S. leaves its last base in Afghanistan. Attorney General Garland reimposes the moratorium on federal executions. House is playing rope-a-dope with the Senate on the budget resolution. White House garners international backing on their global minimum corporate tax proposal. Sha'Carri Richardson, U.S. track athlete, may be banned from the Olympics because she used weed. Lastly, the Pentagon plans to spend almost $200 billion on updated nukes and nary a peep in Congress. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us on a Friday. Emma Vigeland is out today. Just a reminder, on Monday, we will all be out. However, we will do a reprise of one of my favorite interviews from 2020. From 2020 or 2021? 2020? That has relevance to July 4th. I cannot recommend listening to this enough. It has to do a little bit with Reconstruction, but also 4th of July. Well, 5th of July. It's 5th of July appropriate. It's also 4th of July appropriate. Frederick Douglass. It is, you're going to want to listen to this. So check it out on Monday or watch it. I don't know why I always say listen. You can watch it too. It's pretty dynamic. I think I probably raised my eyebrows and curled my lips a couple of times during the course of it. So check that out. Thanks for joining us today. We will be talking to Ari Berman next week on Wednesday about what the Supreme Court has done. But between the cases that we talked about with Mark Stern yesterday and these two cases that came down basically as we were speaking with him yesterday, one dealing with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the concept of racial disparity, the other dealing with a California law that required disclosure of dark money, or not dark money because it was disclosed. This 1-2 punch by the Supreme Court is both stunning and somewhat predictable with the 6-3 court. We are just at the beginning. It's impossible for me to say this dramatically enough. We are just at the beginning of the unwinding of so much that has been built, insufficient as it is, on the unwinding of elements that enhanced our democracy. I am certainly open to the critique of, you know, to what extent we have a democracy when our politicians are far more responsive to the to money than anything else. But if that is your concern, things got a lot worse yesterday. A lot worse. And they indicate that they're going to get a lot worse in the future. 6-3 Supreme Court is not only dramatically different than a 4-4 or a 4-5 or even a 5-4 conservative court. 6-3 means that the margin of error, that one where, oh, you know, Clarence Thomas took issue this because he has these idiosyncrasies, that's over. That's over. This is, and if you watch this program in 2016, we said at the time, the most lasting implications of a Donald Trump win were going to be the Supreme Court. And we have yet to even begin to understand that, I think. Voting rights, access to the courts, limits on corporate power, ability for government to regulate corporations, ability for government to perform some of the basic tasks that that the vast majority of us assume that government is supposed to do. The idea that we could, this Supreme Court, when Anthony Kennedy sat on it, through the last one was Citizens United, but there was a series of cases, basically made it almost impossible to limit how much money can flow into our politics. Anthony Kennedy pretended that it was about, well, we still have disclosure. Well, yesterday, a huge stake was driven into the heart of that concept of disclosure. And again, we're at the beginning of this. At one point, people have to understand the enormous power that rests with the Supreme Court. And you can deny, and I'd be the first one to say that it shouldn't be this way, but it is. And even if you are someone who believes that we need to get rid of the Supreme Court, we are that much further away from having the democracy to be able to even do that. There are 9 people, really 6 at this point, who wield more power than I think broadly we have any concept of. They do not have the constraints of other of politicians. They simply have no constraints except for ones that are in their minds about their notion within history, but the context in which they come from, the waters in which they swim, the narrowness of their constituencies, means they are basically unconstrained. Hugely important, hugely overlooked, particularly by the left in this country, sadly. With that said, let's take a look at, you know, we still do have the ability, I think, to pass a big infrastructure bill. To the extent that there's any obstacles to that, they'd be Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. Here's Joe Manchin, and this is a guy walking a tightrope. He forged this Gang of 10 bipartisan bill. The Republicans are scurrying around now to figure out, like, wait a second, how can we sink this even though we have signed up for it? So far, the only thing that they've got, landed on is it shouldn't be tied to the reconciliation bill. And Joe Biden realized that he may have made a mistake in being so public about it, so he backed off that. Here is Chris Cuomo trying to get Joe Manchin in a similar jam. But Joe Manchin finesses this quite well. This is going to sound mealy-mouthed to you, but I perceive this as very hopeful.
So now we go to your side of the ball, Senator, on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You guys put a deal together. The president mm-hmm. likes the deal. Your party doesn't like the deal. They say we need the companion bill through reconciliation to get all the things that the bipartisan group of senators couldn't find. Is it, in your mind, something that must happen, the reconciliation bill?
Well, nothing must happen because this is the legislature. Things that we think that would happen and should happen sometimes doesn't happen. Is it something I think that we need? Absolutely. Both of them we need.
But the people on the left flank in your party, Senator, say they won't give you your compromise bill on infrastructure if they don't get their bill on reconciliation.
Let me say this. If my Democrat colleagues and friends walk away from the largest infrastructure, traditional infrastructure, roads and bridges and internet services and rail services, and you name it, we did it. Lead pipes, getting rid of all that. If they would walk away from that and let the perfect be the enemy of the good, shame on us now. I don't know what the heck would happen in 2022 if we can't take a win.
Senator Joe Manchin, thank you very
much. Aside from the incredibly abrupt ending there, I don't know what they edited out, but this is Joe Manchin basically saying, I'm going to vote for the reconciliation bill. Like, I'm going to make that happen. And I'm just going to pretend like there isn't any, this isn't a leverage situation. Because gosh, I'd be surprised if they voted against the first one. I mean, so Manchin is both signaling to the progressives, and frankly, it's not just the progressives in the House and in the Senate who want to pass the reconciliation bill. There seems to be broad support for the concept of it, and maybe even the size, and then maybe how it's distributed is not quite exactly settled. But there he is giving, in some ways, assuring, I'm going to vote for the reconciliation bill. I won't be a problem with that. But he also can't admit that it is tied to the fate of the bipartisan bill is tied to the reconciliation bill, because that gives essentially a weapon to the Republicans, and they have then some type of, like, at least some public justification for sinking it.
Basically, the moderate Republicans need to be able to play dumb enough to vote for it.
This is just a bunch of people walking around pretending like they don't know what's going on. And in fact, they do know what's going on. Mitch McConnell is desperate to try and figure out how he sinks this bill. And the Democrats so far have played this quite well. Give me mealy-mouthed Democrats every day who are passing $5, $6 trillion, $4 trillion worth of infrastructure. I'll take that. Particularly when that infrastructure includes, like, health care, elderly care, paid leave. We'll see what's in these bills. But so far, those are good numbers anyways. Meanwhile, lastly, let's just do this as well. We have one more clip of a former moderate, I mean, conservative Democrat. And this is just absolutely bizarre. And there just seems to be, like, this branding mechanism with moderate Democrats. Claire McCaskill, she failed in a re-election bid. For some reason, Democratic sources cite her knowledge on how to get elected in places where she didn't get elected. She didn't get reelected. And but this is just bizarre. I certainly believe there should be a commission on January 6th. About, I think it's helpful both politically and important in terms of the country. I think there's also reason to believe that there may have been Republican politicians involved in this. But I'll remind you, this is also a person who has been saying for years, we got to be bipartisan, and believed all sorts of bipartisan nonsense, or at least pushed it as both a senator and as a commentator. She has a very odd new tradition in her family in celebrating July 4th. Listen to how people reacted to this.
Into this 4th of July weekend.
We're going to start a new family tradition in my family on the 4th of July. And every 4th of July going forward, we're going to watch that video that the New York Times put together of January 6th.
All right, Claire McCaskill, have a great 4th of July to you and your family. Joe, same to you. We will.
I was going to say, what's his name, the commentator?
Willie Geist.
Willie Geist. I don't play poker with that guy. Don't play poker with that guy. Hey, he took a moment to sort of like, wait, I'm sorry. Did you just say that? What? They're going to replay that video of the New York by the New York Times of January 6th.
I mean, that's an insane thing to do, even if you were doing that on January 6th every year. But July 4th.
Yes. It, you know, like, look, I understand the personal motivation that people in that capital must have to find out what went on. And I understand the idea that if you worked in that place at one point, that you would also feel some type of personal, you know, sort of, outrage. But that's one of the biggest problems with senators, is that their personal relationships with other senators trumps the idea that you're voting on legislation that's going to impact the lives of, at the very least, 300 million people. I mean, everybody has their own traditions. I'm not going to begrudge anybody that, but that is odd. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton. Folks, today's program, Emma's really going to be bummed that she's not here today. But I'll say it right now, just because she's not here. Summer's here. The living ain't easy if you got swamp ass. Right? How are you going to stay on top of your sweaty bottom? Well, how do I do it? I never sweat. But
not walking home these past few days?
No, never.
Wow.
Never. Brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install. These are the two things that people are always very surprised about, at least what I hear back from people. Both, you know, like, not confidants, whatever, people I know via the show and people I know off the show, you know, before the outside of the show. Two things that always shock them about the Hello Tushy bidet. One is how relatively inexpensive it is, because they hear bidet, they think thousands of dollars. This is much, much less expensive. And two, how easy it is to install. It attaches to your existing toilet. All you got to do, basically change out the toilet seat, and then you just attach it to the existing plumbing that is there. You don't need electricity. Cuts your toilet paper use by 80%. It's just a more efficient and really an appropriate way to clean yourself that way. And the thing cleans itself, too, with the Smart Spray automatic nozzle. It has a 60-day risk-free guarantee. It has a 12-month warranty. And if you already have the classic Hello Tushy, upgrade to the 3.0 right now. You will be happy you did. Defeat swamp ass. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. Check it out. Also, today's episode sponsored by Magic Spoon. And every day, except for yesterday, I couldn't eat yesterday because of an endoscopy. Magic Spoon, huge part of my day. Frankly, I eat the stuff throughout basically the day here, but on weekends I have for show. I have it for breakfast. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar. It has 13 to 14 grams of protein, depending on the flavor. Only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories per serving. It is keto-friendly. It is gluten-free. It is grain-free. It is soy-free. It is low-carb and is GMO-free. You can build your own box because they ship in a box of four. You can have 4 of the available flavors to build your own custom box. Get a variety pack, cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and cinnamon. I don't know if they have, sometimes they have special flavors that I signed up for the VIP thing on my phone. It's available to other people too. Anybody could, once you become a customer. But I got the chocolate and peanut butter and I devoured that box. I think there may be a little bit left, but I nailed that thing. Hard. It was delicious. I've mixed it before, but somehow when they mix it, it's better even. Cinnamon is fantastic. They have special seasonal flavors. They're great. Sometimes I wonder if they keep advertising on the show just because I've been buying so much that they think that it's doing really well. I probably shouldn't have said that. Now they're going to go check their records. I do it through a sock puppet. MagicSpoon.com/majority report. Grab your delicious cereal and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout. You save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, it's MagicSpoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report to save $5 off. Okay, want to welcome back to the show the proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo and the columnist at Salon.com, Heather Parton, otherwise known as Digby. Heather, thanks so much for joining us today. Oh, she's connecting to audio right now. Heather, can you hear me?
I can. Can you see me? Everything good?
Everything's great. Thanks so much for joining us today. Okay. I know we're dealing with limited time today.
Okay.
And there is a lot of stuff going on. We're going to talk about what's going on with the Supreme Court next week. That is maybe not a shock, except for when it arrives, it becomes it just is stunning. John Roberts has been wanting to get rid of the Voting Rights Act since his days as a lawyer for the Reagan administration. And the myth, the sort of fig leaf of disclosure of campaign finance rules, also sort of hacked away at the knees by Sam Alito out in California. We could talk about the Trump Weisselberg indictment, but I think we're going to have time to talk about that in the future. We spoke about this on the exclusive Peacock show that we do that we interview you for, but I think it bears repeating. Donald Rumsfeld died this week, and you and I both sort of started our professional careers in talking about politics. You writing about politics in the wake of in my mind, really 3 things: the 2020 election the 2000 election of George Bush, or selection as we referred to it at the day, 9/11 and our response to it, and particularly the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, which lasted almost 2 decades, arguably ongoing, and cost hundreds of thousands of lives, trillions of dollars. And Donald Rumsfeld was as responsible for that third thing as just about anybody alive, it seems to me. And one thing that you and I both talked about was how important it is to contextualize this man without him being allowed to sort of drift off into the night like he literally did, without putting a flag down and a marker and saying this guy was responsible for heinous atrocities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was one of the architects, maybe the main architect, of the invasion of Iraq and the sort of pie in the sky ideas about what that was going, the changes that was going to bring. I mean, remember when, on 9/11, on that day, you know, I've noticed all the pundits and the various commentators on this, Defense Department reporters, going on and on about how Rumsfeld on that day, he was very brave. He ran out of his office and he saved some people and dug through the rubble or whatever. I think people forget, though, that within minutes of that happening, his aides were taking notes about how he wanted to find a way to tie in that attack with Saddam Hussein. I mean, it took him it was on the same day that he was putting that together, knowing very well that there was no connection between what had happened on 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. They knew it was Osama bin Laden. They knew what was going on. Remember, I mean, we know people had been running around with their hair on fire, right? I mean, that has been well documented in the 9/11 report. So we knew he knew, and yet from the very beginning, he set out to put America on this path to, in his mind and the minds of others, Dick Cheney among the most important, to remake the Middle East. He was the guy who said, don't bother to go to the UN. I mean, he was pushing that from the very beginning. We need to go it alone. We need to establish our dominance. He was the one who thought that invading Afghanistan would be a snap and that the Taliban would be forever vanquished. I mean, how's that working out right now? I mean, good luck with that. So, I mean, this guy was, and you mentioned torture, of course, and we talked about that. He was one of them who was pushing it hard. And in fact, it's been documented that he believed that the information gleaned from torture was much more reliable than information gleaned by any other means. That's the mindset that we're talking about with this man. And, he goes way, way back, and he has a long history in American politics going all the way back to the 1960s. He was sort of a Nixon Republican when he was a member of Congress, and he joined the Nixon administration and was part of the Ford administration. And they were lying all that time as well. He and Dick Cheney were two peas in a pod, lying about the Soviet, menace and the Soviet, military might in order to, push this idea of American imperialism. I mean, he is the guy. And when he got that job as the Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, I don't think that he anticipated he was going to have the chance that he got, but he took full advantage of it to push these ideas that he and Dick Cheney and others like him had been pushing for decades. And it is a low point. And as we discussed yesterday, this particular adventure of theirs is what set the table for what we went through with Donald Trump. I mean, people don't see the connection there, and it's a big, big mistake. The lies, we talk about Trump being the liar in chief, and he lies about everything, lies, 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 it's all that. Well, I mean, he was just more, crude about it. He was more clumsy about it. The Bush administration, they were professional liars, and they did it in ways that were absolutely devastating to millions of people, and no better than Donald Trump, downplaying the pandemic. I mean, it's the same concept. These people have no conscience, and they result in mass death. And, that's what we're looking at today, and that's what we were looking at then. Then it was Iraqis and Afghans. Today it is Americans. So, gee, how'd that happen, right?
Yeah, so, I can't agree with you more on that construct. And I just to remind people, we know from Richard Clark, who was the chief counterterrorism advisor for the United States president at the time of the 9/11 attack. And in his book, he recounts that Donald Rumsfeld said shortly after that day, maybe it was the next day, maybe that day, that he wanted to bomb Iraq, even though there was no evidence of their involvement, simply because there was, quote, more good targets in Iraq than there was Afghanistan. And I agree with you. I don't think on the day that he got picked as Secretary of Defense that he could have imagined having a better opportunity. But I do think that he would have looked for any opportunity in which they could have done this. And there was a you know, for him, part of it was, I think, that he was also part of the broad thinking that came from that Project for a New American Century. I don't know if he signed that actual document, but certainly if Dick Cheney was in on it, Rumsfeld was on board. This notion of the U.S. being a hyperpower and their term, not mine, a hyperpower that was managing low-level conflicts around the world. And he wanted the opportunity to reshape the U.S. military. In fact, we did get out of the Iraq and Afghanistan, these 20-year wars, an expansion of what can be sort of conveniently called JSOC, which is the Joint Special Operations Command. And there is essentially a mini sort of hyper uber army that we have that can be deployed covertly throughout the world. And it is, frankly, as we speak, when we talk about 900, personnel in Syria, and we talk about people staying behind in Afghanistan, or we talk about operations that are happening in Somalia or in the nether regions of Pakistan or in Iraq or wherever around the world, and probably some places in Latin America, we're talking about JSOC. And this was Donald Rumsfeld's vision of a covert, mini military within the military that can go and do things without paying the costs, without being constrained by U.S. public opinion and awareness. And this is also the guy who said, literally, take the gloves off, unshackle those people who are dealing with our prisoners. Because, like what you said, he was promoting torture and knew that's all he had to do to promote that torture. And I just want to remind people, regardless of whose numbers you use, you can use the Defense Department numbers. You can use numbers that come out of Brown. You can use numbers that have come out of various UN. I mean, there's been multiple different organizations over the years that have assessed what we did to Iraq and to the Iraqi people. And if you start with the Defense Department, you're talking about killing well over 100,000, maybe 150,000 civilians. If you go to anybody else's numbers that people think are probably more reasonable, you're talking about killing hundreds of thousands, up to a million. Again, you know, I don't know if there is a moral difference between killing 100,000 people and killing 200,000 or 500,000, but the amount of human suffering that we caused, and that he was as responsible as any single individual could be, is just mind-blowing. And never mind the millions of refugees and the destabilization that's happened there and anything that could subsequently come from that. We've seen it over time. Everything you just said about sending this country, he was part of a presidency that's really careened this country in many respects. I don't think we're done with that journey. I just want to remind people, people talk about the authoritarian nature of the Trump regime, essentially. And John Dean wrote a book in 2006 called The Conscience of a Conservative. And he wrote that in conjunction with the guy named Bob Altemeyer, who was an expert on right-wing authoritarianism. And John Dean was talking about the authoritarianism that came out of the Bush administration. Everything that we see today in the Republican Party, everything. The politicization of the Department of Justice, The politicization of every aspect of the functioning of government, the attack on the administrative state, the authoritarian streak in the Republican Party, the sort of training that we have as a public about lying, this all emanated out of that Bush administration. George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld. Hard to pick three other people in the our modern history who are more responsible for what we have gone through and what I would imagine we would go through and just human suffering than those three. I mean, Henry Kissinger, definitely up there. I would say maybe beyond honorable mention, but in terms of the way that we now, you know, these people should not be allowed to pass without this being marked. And you know, the fact that Donald Rumsfeld never suffered any accountability for it, maybe he couldn't travel in Europe in the same way that he wanted to, or maybe, you know, some places there were some concerns, I think, at different times that they might he might be held liable for some human rights violations. But aside from that, it really is, frankly, a shame. You know, maybe he was a nice husband. Maybe he was a nice father. I don't know. I never knew him that way. I knew him as just the guy who spread this incredible horror to humanity.
Well, absolutely. And think about, you know, the corollary with him, I think, is that people think about is Robert McNamara, right? The Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam era, who also lied and, you know, basically allowed he knew that the United States was losing the war and that people were dying needlessly. And the whole thing was a quagmire and a mess. And yet he kept quiet about it. The difference between McNamara and Rumsfeld, and I'm not giving McNamara any credit here, to say that he expressed regrets. He actually felt bad in his life. And in his later years, as he went back in, he expressed, you know, tremendous regret for having been part of that. And you know, he took responsibility for it. Rumsfeld never for a minute had a second thought, as far as we know. And I don't think he did. I mean, no, but none of the things, even people who are, you know, were friendly toward him or in the last few days talking about his legacy, such as it is, have suggested that he ever had a moment of regret. That guy just doesn't have regrets and didn't have regrets. He thought everything was just fine. And I mean, that really tells you something about the character of this person. I mean, the sureness with which he, you know, did all of these things was just, I mean, it was an amazing thing to see. And I do want to mention, I mean, at least, you know, say something about this. The media has to take a big, big, you know, dollop of the responsibility for what happened there. They worshiped Donald Rumsfeld at the time. I'm sure you remember, I'm sure everybody listening remembers this, you know, the press conferences that Rumsfeld would hold. I mean, they were like, you know, comedy stand-up routines, and the press would just laugh and laugh. They wrote these amazing feature stories about him. I mean, you had these conservative women who were calling him Rumstud and saying that he was the hottest guy around, and, you know, comparing him to Bill Clinton. And I mean, it was just sickening. It was an absolutely sickening display. And it wasn't just about Rumsfeld. Of course, the press was on board from the minute 9/11 happened with whatever the Bush administration wanted to do. And they bear responsibility for what happened there, because they did not question it. They didn't feature any of the people who were questioning it. And there were millions of us in the United States and all over the world, including most of America's allies, which Rumsfeld and Cheney said to take a hike. They never liked allies anyway. I mean, you talk about parallels between you know, George Bush and his administration and Donald Trump. There's one for you. Allies. You need them, right?
I know you remember this, but people should understand, and, you know, a lot of our audience is young, and they don't remember this. But, you know, you see, like, the press talk about how Donald Trump, he goes to France and he's rude to, you know, shaking, you know, Macron's hand too hard or whatever. We had Republicans who literally forced the cafeteria in Congress to change the name of French fries to Freedom Fries, so that because we were getting pushback about attacking Iraq. I mean, I remember Thomas Friedman writing a piece at that time about comparing a trip that he'd made to France, where on the menu there was some like asterisk next to the beef, saying that it was, you know, not factory farm or from the United States or something to that effect. I can't remember the specifics of it, but it just occurs to me. And he was comparing their arrogance about what meat they would eat to the fact that they won't join us.
I remember that
bombing and attack on Iraq. And it was this, Rumsfeld and Bush had to have this coalition of the willing, and
right.
Just the whole era, has gotten whitewashed by Trump and frankly by a press that I think does not want to account for its responsibility during that era, frankly. And frankly, I also don't think that they've learned much of a lesson. I remember that the day that Donald Trump launched attacks on Syria, sitting on MSNBC and watching, you know, all of the usual suspects. I happened to be on air that at the moment that the announcement was there in terms of the bombing, and everybody on there, short of myself, and I think the host Chris Hayes at the time was like, "We should do this. We'll come up with a plan after we bomb." And certainly that was, you heard no response to Joe Biden launching similar attacks just 5 days ago. And just
no discussion of it. Does anybody even know it happened? I mean, it's like it didn't happen. I was shocked by that, to tell you the truth.
And we, I think, as a country are somewhat, I guess, we have the ability to deny these things or just ignore them because we had a 20-year-long war in Afghanistan. We had a nearly 20-year-long war in Iraq, and we just walked around every day as our tax dollars were killing tens of thousands of people, ultimately hundreds of thousands, and there was nothing. We didn't pay attention. We weren't allowed to see any of the bodies coming back from Iraq. It was just, it taught the American public to just like enjoy, you know, their lives as this one sort of narrow apparatus is going and involved in creating mass death and destruction. So
and keep in mind, too, just as a final thing, remember how much money is being spent on the military. And that goes from Bush to Trump. I mean, they always like spending money on the military, but the spending now is overwhelming. While everybody's talking about debt and whatever and trying to get back, oh, we can't really afford this or that. Well, you know, take a look over there, because that is, it is so bloated now that I can't even imagine what are they spending it on other than military contractors, which I guess is what it's really all about.
Yep. And I guess reinvigorating our nukes. Yeah. Heather, thanks so much for joining us. I know it was tight squeeze. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam. Have a great weekend.
You too. Okay. We're not going to take a break. Let's just bring our next guest on. He is the executive director of the Writers Guild of America, Lowell Peterson. A couple of disclosures, just in the spirit of full disclosure, we should say, I was a member of the Writers Guild. Cannot remember, in all honesty, if I was the East or the West, but nevertheless, in a different life, I would write half-hour sitcom scripts, and it's been probably over a decade at this point, and my membership lapsed, but I should say I am vested in terms of a pension. Knock on wood, that day will come eventually. And we should also say that this show is runs on the Peacock app on the Choice channel, which is one of two newsrooms that are being unionized by my understanding is a majority of the workers there. We're going to ask Lowell about this. And Lowell and I, we spoke on the Peacock exclusive Peacock show. But I got a lot of pushback from audience members who want to hear some of it now. And so it worked out today because we needed a little time. And so, Lo, welcome to the program. And let me just put this in the context of, we have seen over the past 2 or 3 years, it seems to me, an enormous amount of organizing amongst journalists and news people in a way that seems unprecedented. Is my sense of that correct? And again, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sam. It's great to talk to you again. Yeah, we have seen an enormous uptick in interest in journalists organizing. The MSNBC newsroom, by the way, it's a 2/3 of the people in the newsroom signed a public petition saying, yes, we want to be represented by the Writers Guild of America East. It wasn't secret. They didn't do it anonymously. They put their names on the dotted line. We've organized a lot of digital native newsrooms in recent years. As you know, HuffPost, Vox, Vice, et cetera, all represented by the Writers Guild of America East. We recently negotiated a contract at CBSN, which is the 24/7 live streaming service of CBS Network News, and we also brought in their Chicago network affiliate or local affiliate. So there's been a lot, and we're not the only union organizing, but we've added thousands of journalists to our ranks in the past 5 years, and we will bring in another 1,000 in the next year with MSNBC and Hearst and Bustle, and there's definitely an uptick to your point. There's definitely an explosion of interest amongst professional journalists, and hey, I want to be represented by a union and want to negotiate the terms of my employment. How do I do it?
And what accounts for that? I mean, is that because there's a contraction that's happening, or is it because that there's an expansion and there's a flattening of compensation for people? I mean, what accounts for that as opposed to, like, I don't know, the way it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago?
I think it's two things. I think there is definitely a sense of insecurity. There are definitely journalists who say, wow, I'm looking at a lot of consolidation. The companies are coming together. There's layoffs. The pandemic didn't exactly bolster people's confidence in their ability to stay employed. Advertising revenues are not so great sometimes. So I think there's definitely a sense of defensiveness. I think there's also a sense that this is particularly true in digital, but I'd say it's true in cable news as well. Like, this is actually a place where I'm going to spend my career. This isn't just a way station on the way to a real job. This is the real job. And so what can I do to make the real job a real career? And I think what people are concluding is collective bargaining is the way to do it. I think it's also they've seen that we're successful. You know, it's not just an abstract idea. Hey, I want to be a union member because it sounds cool. It's because they look at their colleagues at other shops that have organized and they say, well, actually, the union, the Writers Guild of America East, negotiated a really good contract. They locked in benefits. They got me a greater voice on the job. They've made gains in equity and inclusion. So, you know, it sort of spirals as people see that it actually can make a difference. It's not just an ethereal notion.
Yeah, I wondered about that because we see, you know, you see things like that. I mean, Brendan and I were talking because trying to convince my kid to go to overnight camp, and there's you get these situations with camp, but it happens with all different types of things where, like, there are neighborhoods or towns where there's a lot of people who just happen to go to this camp that is randomly, and it's a function of kids going 1 year, coming back the next year and saying this was great, and they come back. It sort of feels like the momentum, and I think they're trying to do this. Actually, I think the AFL-CIO is trying to do this with Amazon shops. Once you get one or two shops that unionize, those people start to become evangelists and you start to get more. Is that basically the dynamic?
Absolutely. They talk to their friends. So if I'm, say, a writer producer at MSNBC, I know somebody at ABC News or CBSN or Vox Media or Vox Entertainment. And I say, well, what's it like? Or often what happens is people go to work at a currently non-union place and they say, you know, when, at my old shop, we just negotiated a great contract. So there's definitely a community building aspect to this. And of course, we mercilessly take advantage of it because we want to make sure that our organizers keep track of people as they move around and make sure that, you know, people communicating with other people and making a decision to take action is fundamentally what this is about. To my point about it not being an abstraction, it's very real. It's very much like you and me having a conversation, Sam, and me saying to you, here's what it looks like. And then you having a conversation with a colleague. And that's how you build a strong labor movement. It's a movement of actual individual employees that is fostered, you know, by professional organizers. But if there isn't support at the grassroots level, at the level of one-on-one conversations between employees, it won't succeed. But it's happening. People are talking to each other and they're saying, yeah, let's do this.
Okay, so walk me through this. There were two-thirds. You have a bargaining unit, and that's determined if I – and correct me where I'm wrong here, because I've been trying to sort of like understand this for quite some time. The unit sort of self-defines on some level, right? Everybody who is this type of producer or does this type of work or doesn't manage people, but and those are the parameters. They self-define, and they – come to the union. They say, we want to unionize. We have 10%, 15%, 20%, and we need to start to organize. And then they start, they get some advice. I could talk to some more of your colleagues and this and that. And so the workers at MSNBC and the Choice, and we should say we're licensed. So we're not, no one gets paid by NBC here or any of those entities. We license our show there. I don't really have much contact with these folks. Sometimes I've gone on as a guest, and I may have know some of them. But so they organize, they come out and they sign this pledge essentially, and they do it publicly. And they say, okay, two-thirds of us, want to do this. What happens then? And B, is it typical that they're going to sign their name publicly? Because that to me seems like that took some guts a little bit, right? There's some risk associated with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not typical. Usually the card signing process is anonymous or confidential. So we get people to sign cards and then we say, we're going to keep them confidential. If the employer says, we'll recognize this union, we'll agree to sit down at the bargaining table, but you have to prove that you have a majority, then we'll get somebody, a preacher, an arbitrator, to take a look at the cards and say, yeah, that's a majority. In this case, people went a step further, which is courageous and shows their commitment. And they signed it. They signed a petition that says, we authorize the Writers Guild of America East to represent us. And then we went public with it. That was a bold move. I think it shows the level of solidarity that they have. I think that will help us ensure that we get recognized. And it also helps us when we actually sit down at the bargaining table for the company to know that that many people are willing to take that level of risk. So if the company starts stonewalling us at the bargaining table saying, no, we can't agree to that, we can say, you know, these people really mean it. They're not hiding behind the union. They've put their names on the line. You have to agree to a reasonable collective bargaining agreement.
So what? Okay. So what? Where is the status now? So they've come out and announced this. What are the two things that can happen once they announce this type of thing, and what did happen?
Well, so the preferred method, and the method we use in 95% of our organizing drives. So we've done a lot of them, as you mentioned. We've had many dozens of organizing drives in the past few years. Usually, the employer will voluntarily recognize. They'll say, "We believe you." And sometimes they ask an arbitrator to count the cards. And sometimes they say, look, we know our employees well enough to know that a majority of them signed up. And then we at that point, we sign a recognition agreement and the company agrees to sit down at the table and negotiate in good faith. And we always get a contract. Sometimes it takes a year. Sometimes it takes 6 months. Sometimes it takes a year and a half. But we know how to apply leverage and get good contracts. That's the preferred method. That's what we proposed to MSNBC. They immediately started saying, oh, no, that's not right. People have to hear the other side of the story, as if professional journalists hadn't already engaged in critical thinking. You know, that's the definition of a journalist, right? They question everything. And believe me, they question everything here. Nonetheless, the alternative is to file a petition at the National Labor Relations Board, which we're typically reluctant to do. In this case, we decided to do it just a couple of days ago because we knew that we had the votes. We knew that the anti-union campaign that the company is presumably going to trot out is not going to work. People have already thought about these issues. So we're going to do it. And we hope to have an election really soon. And the NLRB then sends out ballots and people say yes union or no union. They have a choice. And they mail them back and then you get certified.
I have to say, it's just occurred to me and I apologize to the audience, but I'm going to give the opportunity. If the company wants to make the argument as to what the other side is, I mean, I didn't mean to laugh when you said that, because I just, it's, you know, it's a ostensibly branded as a progressive or liberal, like pro-union entity. And I'm not sure I understand what the other argument is, but I mean, if you want to take a crack at it, what is the other side of the argument when two thirds of the people say, like, we want to unionize? The company comes back and says, but if you get a union, you're gonna, I mean, I look, I was a member of the Writers Guild. There was union dues, but it was worth it. I worked in show business. I could tell you, like, if they could have gotten me for a nickel, they would have done it, and they would have figured out, and they would have, you know, particularly when there's a lot of competition, they'll put people. So what, for the sake of fairness, but I also want to make it clear that I'm willing to have, you know, consider this an open invitation to have somebody come on from the company and say, like, this is the problem with the union. But what would be your perspective on what they would say?
Well, we actually do know what they've been saying, because every utterance from management that questions unionization, we hear about, and sometimes in real time. It's a very transparent newsroom. Their argument is, yeah, collective bargaining is good everywhere, except here. So the logic of it, I have to admit, escapes me. Everybody knew they had to pay union dues. Of course, you have to pay union dues. That's part of paying for the service of negotiations and enforcing contracts and protecting you from getting whittled down to getting paid only a nickel, right? Which, as you point out, is these are profit-making companies. It's not necessarily evil Snidely Whiplash. It's how they make money. So our goal is to make sure that the value that our members bring is properly calculated and paid. So I think the basic argument is, gee, why can't we all be friends? Honestly, there's no reason we can't be friends in a union environment. We have lots of collective bargaining agreements with lots of employers, and it's not like we go in with pitchforks and torches every 2 days. We just negotiate hard. We enforce our contracts, but we understand the need to have a professional working relationship. We have contracts at NBC. We have collective bargaining agreements and members who work under them in the same building as MSNBC. And in fact, I'll let you know, no big surprise, our members at 30 Rock strongly support this union effort at MSNBC. So everybody who actually works under a guild contract says, you should do this. So there isn't a logical argument that MSNBC could make, but I think they just want to keep us out of power and retain the power themselves, and they'll come up with something. You're right. It's weird to have a progressive network try to come up with some reason why unionizing everyone else is fine, but not my people. That doesn't make any sense. But I think that's what they'll probably say.
And to be fair, I should also say that they're, it's not, I don't know how the management works in the context of MSNBC. There may be, shareholder pressure, I don't know. But we should say that this is not like a standalone company. It's owned by other entities, Comcast and whatnot. And
Comcast, so, yeah.
There may be shareholders say, like, well, if you play this out, we'll have a better 2021, and then we'll make the deal in 2022 or something like that. Who knows how that works there? Well, Lowell, I appreciate your coming on. I guess we just keep an eye out and watch what the National Labor Relations Board does, right? This winds through. Is that how it works?
It winds through. I will tell you, there is extremely little chance that we won't end up sitting at the bargaining table. When I spoke with the labor relations people there, I said, look, we're going to be sitting at the bargaining table. Why do you have to push back and fight here? So I am confident that in a matter of weeks, maybe a month, that will be the outcome. But, you never know. And we'll definitely keep you posted. I appreciate your paying attention to this. It's important.
All right. Well, thank you, Lowell. I appreciate it, too. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap up things for the week, at least for our Peacock viewers. We'll be right back after this. Mm-hmm. All right, folks. This was the week that was. Want to wish you who are watching us on the Choice channel, on the Peacock app, have a great 4th of July weekend. We will be back on the 6th live, and we will see you then. But make sure you tune in to the replay that we're going to do on Monday. You're going to enjoy that. All right. Do we have now we just had the executive director of the Writers Guild of America East on. And I thought it would be only fair to bring up the other side of that debate. And that, of course, is the executive director.
He's got the show on in the background.
Okay.
No, I don't. Why do people talk about me like I'm not a human being? Oh, I think he's got the show on in the back. I don't think he can hear us anymore. His hearing aid is down. Unbelievable.
I was in the middle of your introduction.
Whoa. Oh, sorry. Okay, I'll step out.
Hold on for a second. Wait a second. I want to do the introduction properly, but are you in like some type of like art studio? Are you?
Let's just say that I put a little money. I had some set design people from the House and Garden channel come over.
It looks like you're in an art studio and you've set up like different things for people to practice on their painting. No, I mean like they've got like it's like a still life with an apple there. Doesn't it?
I can't win.
Doesn't that look like that backdrop look like, honestly, it's been set up as if they're like you're teaching painting there?
No, this is my office. I have a various different. Can you see everything behind me?
Some type of contract where they tell you like you can rent here, but don't put it on the wall. Don't hang anything on the wall. Everything that you put up must on a table with a sheet. Now, can I do your intro?
Yes, you can. In fact, when you're doing my intro, I'm going to clean up the coffee I spilled.
Well, no, wait a second. Honestly, will you look at that? Doesn't it look like that is like a painter's like a there's a class
that or what someone puts up at a wake?
Yes, Andy, is that are we looking at like some? He doesn't even put on his. He can't even hear me, Andy.
What'd you say about me now? I told you I was.
I'm asking, is Brendan just raised the possibility that maybe there's a wake going on there, and those are like artifacts from whoever passed away's life.
I can't believe that. Now, I told Brendan not to bring that up. That's the train that my father was buried on. And that flower, those are flowers from my father's funeral.
Don't do that. Don't.
It's wrong. Oh, my father died, and I'm the bad guy. I can't joke about it. Mother died. My father died. My sister died. I only have my brother left. Yet I can't make horrible comments, cheap comments about it.
Gosh, Andy, can I please do your introduction?
Yes.
Okay. So we just heard from the Writers Guild of America executive director, Lowell Peterson. And I thought it would only fair to bring on the opposing view. Which is the executive director of AndyKindler.com, Andy Kindler, who has basically been blacklisted by show business, unable.
That's right.
And I thought we would hear a counterpoint.
Canceled.
You know
what's amazing? All these white people, all of these, and some of them have no talent at all, and yet they've been canceled somehow. They're not getting work. So any white person who's not getting work, they've been canceled. Isn't that obvious?
I mean, it happens in show business quite a bit. I mean, literally.
No, canceled. Even if you see a white person and they're in a movie and they're following along with the lips of the person that they're acting with, right? They're still, if anything happens to them, canceled.
I think I've told this story before, and I'll tell it again. I don't know if you ever saw that thing called Beat Cops that I did with.
I loved it. You and John Benjamin.
Yeah. So I wrote and directed that. It was an independent. We actually did it twice. The first time I co-wrote and directed it, co-wrote it with my friend Charlie Fisher, who you may remember from Who's the Caboose back in the day. And I hired Nick DiPaolo. This is in 1999, I think it was, or somewhere around there. I hired Nick DiPaolo to play like a tough cop to bully Benjamin and I. And I'm talking to Nick, and I didn't know him that well. I just, you know, knew of him a little bit and peripherally. And he's saying, yeah, no, I moved back from L.A. And I'm like, oh, well, why is that? Now, I had done a bunch of sitcoms at this point. Like, I had had quite a run. Like, I had done probably 7 or 8 in the course of 5 years. Right. And so I had run into a lot of different, like, character actors, right? And particularly at that time, they were so formulaic. These were all bad shows, incidentally, I should say. And Nick says to me, goes like, yeah, no, I can't stand it out there. You can't get a job as a white guy. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, right.
Like, I literally did like 4 shows with a guy exactly like you.
Yeah. Yes.
The Italian guy who's just like, and I'm like, if you couldn't get a job, I got news for you, dude. It wasn't Hollywood. Like, there was so many jobs for white comedians, male comedians at that time, that it was like you couldn't like, you were working.
I was working. I mean, when you talk about a field that's open, and I look at first of all, every time I've been on the set, they have to stop and say, Andy. Not directly into the camera. And it's, you know, so, and I'm working, but and many times they go, you are so terrible, but you are, of course, white. So we're going to see if we can.
Honestly, there was, this was the time where there was the UPN, the WB, Fox, CBS, ABC, NBC, and they were all doing shows almost exclusively with comedians. There was no British actors who were coming in jobs like there are today. There was no, like, there was no, they didn't believe actors could, you know, it was all, we're going to put as many stand-ups as we can into right. the half hour, and then we're just going to pump them out. And they were doing like 4 or 5 a night on all these networks. It was just like a complete seller as a, you know, a comedian market. And
right.
to say that, like, there was too many, like, non-white shows in the 90s is just sort of like...
Well, it's built in. Do you know how much racism was built into the business? I mean, the victims of it felt it all the time. But, for example, like, I used to do the speech in Montreal, and I would talk about in the 90s. I go, every time there's a black show, you know, show with black people on it that doesn't work, Hollywood goes, well, we tried the black people. We had them all in one show. And but every time a white show fails, they don't go, we tried the white people again. Right. How come no one point? I mean, and just built in racism. That's just like not even considered.
Yeah. I mean, I think I became very conscious of it because the second show that I had done was called The Show. It was on for 8 or 9 episodes. And I was a whitehead variety. I was the whitehead writer of an all black variety show.
Right.
That was the premise of it. And
if that's something that exists. Oh, right. We'll have it all black.
It was the story of the executive producer, John Bowman, had done the Martin show.
And nobody's more urban than John Bowman.
But the point being that I realized, like, after, you know, it was only the second show I had ever done. I had auditioned for 2 shows, All American Girl, which I got, and then The Show, and that was it. And so I had no idea what auditioning was like in L.A. And it wasn't until, like, the subsequent years after that I realized, like, I never see those guys anymore.
Yeah.
Like I see the same person, like, I think I would walk down the street and I would see Greg Proops like 5 times a day. But I would never see, I never saw like any of the folks I worked with on that show ever again. Like, it was a completely different, segregated world, particularly right. in the 90s in particular.
Oh, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was probably.
I'm sure it was worse before then, and maybe subsequent to. But that was just like, you know, when I was there.
Well, I was around during the 60s and 70s, to some degree, as a young child, everybody was like, then, oh, okay, we've solved all these civil rights things. Let's move it on now, and it's all.
You auditioned for the Dick Van Dyke Show.
I did, but here's the thing: I auditioned for Richie, the small child, and I hated that kid. Oh my God. They said, I tried to sabotage his audition.
You were too big. You were too big for that show. We need a little kid, Andy. Not a college. Not a kid in college.
No, I was. No, I would have been. I could have been 4 years old on that show.
When you auditioned for the Sergeant Bilko show.
Yes. Back then, you didn't have. When you auditioned, they only had one microphone back then. Everybody had to gather around.
That's right. You're doing all those radio plays. Andy,
We had one joke when I started. One joke, Sam. That's it. We shared one joke. I had to walk 20 miles to get to the premise of a joke, another 30 miles to get to the punchline back in my day.
Now, wait a second. Are you in an office? Is this office in your home or are you in a different?
Hold on a second. I have a meeting coming up where I'll be interviewing someone in that chair.
Are you
see the chair?
Office off premise?
Oh yes, I have an office. I'm not at my home.
I think you.
I have my sunny side over, as if my wife ever cooked me breakfast.
You're just pretending. Like what would happen if your wife was actually going to bring you lunch or
breakfast? Hold on 1 second, Seth. No, that's fine. No. French press is fine. No. French press is fine, even though I don't like French press. But the idea is I would accept it.
Right. Now, that's your very, very amenable. Okay.
I think I'm going to keep her. I'm going to keep her, my wife. I think I'll keep her. You don't even remember that commercial.
No, I don't. I don't think.
It goes, my wife, I think I'll keep her. That was the punchline.
Oh, my God.
You look good. You look handsome today. This is the way I thought I would look.
Fridays are always the day I try and dress. I know I shaved. That's what it was. I shaved.
No, but I wanted to look like you when I first came out of the womb. That's what I thought. Good looking Jew like you.
Had a lot of work done.
I have had a lot of work done too, but not on my act, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Can we please get to what this is all about today? Because I saw a clip, Andy, from Ben Shapiro.
Funny guy.
It blew me away.
And was that the double time? Did you guys send me that at double time? Because it sounds like
no.
Because it does sound faster than normal drone.
Very quickly. So we have this clip, but we will play it at double time, actually, because why wouldn't we? But Ben Shapiro has found secret subliminal conservative messages in Hollywood popular movies that we, as, you know, shit libs or leftists or, you know, sock Dems or full on socialists or even arguably like, you know, super radical leftists. We watch these movies and we don't realize.
We don't know. We don't know that they're there.
We don't know that they're there because we embrace them and we're secretly conservative. So let's watch this clip. And I thought, who better than the dawn of Hollywood, the Don Kindler of Hollywood, Andy Kindler, to come and actually, you know, decipher whether this is true or not. So here is Ben Shapiro explaining to all of us how we secretly love conservative narratives.
We're going to be talking about why so many of your favorite movies are secretly conservative. Just want to give a shout out to our friends over at Raycon for sponsoring this video. You want the best pair of wireless earbuds on the market? Raycons are the ones.
Hi, I'm John Krasinski, and I'm hosting SNL with Machine Gun Kelly.
Big week. Huge week.
But no pressure, though.
You better be funny.
Who doesn't love John Krasinski? It makes sense. There's lots of love about John Krasinski. People love The Office. Everybody loves Jim. And of course, he made a delightful little at-home news show that went viral during the pandemic. He's the type of dude that seems to resonate with Americans of all types. I think one of the reasons why people like him is because of the not-so-obvious conservative values in some of his movies, particularly in A Quiet Place. And that got me thinking about some other Hollywood projects that have some kind of sneaky, under-the-radar conservative qualities that happen to be widely celebrated by the left, unintentionally. I'm going to show you what I mean with a few really recent movies. The endings of these movies are the parts that best exemplify the values. So I'm just warning you now, these are big spoilers for all of the movies we're about to discuss.
Pause, pause.
On Krasinski, like people, the conservatives like him because he loves the troops, and he does like Jack Ryan press gambits talking about how much he loves the troops and that how great it was to talk to like the CIA in like doing that movie. That's why he...
Oh, is that what it is with him?
Yeah, I thought they liked him because he's a handsome guy and he was on The Office. Isn't he like a heartthrob? Isn't he comedy's heartthrob? And I'm not putting him down. I'm not putting him down just because this guy gets a role in every movie because he's handsome, right? And I'm not just saying he's just handsome. He has a depth to his acting roles that are, he gets down deep. But he's not cast because of his secret conservative values. I'm just going to go out on a limb right now.
All right, well, let me tell you that. Let's start with this. Did you watch Quiet Place? Did you see this movie?
No, I didn't see that movie. But is it? I did actually. Oh, is that the movie that had conservative values that I didn't realize were in the movie? I went to see that movie because I thought it was going to have celebrities drinking blood of babies. So I get in there. All of a sudden, it's this Quiet Place where the guy is saying that even in case of rape or incest, Krasinski says, he opens the movie, even in the case of rape or incest, a woman should be forced to carry. That's what he says in the very first scene. And I thought he was going to drink blood.
No, that's a different movie, I think.
Oh,
I saw A Quiet Place, and it was the one where there was some type of like invasion or something. I can't remember that they come after you when you're loud, and this family figured it out, and they were on the run, but they had to be very quiet. They had to be very quiet. They had to be very quiet. And the family, and like Matt, you saw this, right? Did you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Was most of like the planet wiped out? Like it was sort of like a post-apocalyptic.
Yeah. You're going to like pharmacies to like get drugs and stuff.
That's really important to keep in mind here. It is post-apocalyptic because what Ben Shapiro is going to tell you the secret conservative message in this movie may have something to do with the post-apocalyptic quality of this film.
No. He's saying that blowing up the world is a conservative value. Isn't that what he's saying? Well, a world nuclear war is the conservative value.
But these were space invaders, right, Matt? Okay, so space invaders. All right, but continue.
Libs,
right, exactly.
About to discuss. If you don't want to know what happens, jump ahead to the next film that you've already seen, or jump all the way ahead to the part where I tell you why so many movies generally are conservative, even though they don't mean to be. Let's start with A Quiet Place. A Quiet Place was released to overwhelmingly positive reviews. John DeFore from Hollywood Reporter said, quote, "Scenes of what passes for ordinary life, but the screenplay focus."
Can we double speed time him on this? I don't want to get...
The box office on this movie, enormous. It was a very low budget film. It made $340 million at the box office. Numbers that are not going to be paralleled in the new post-COVID era. For those who haven't seen the movie, there's a family that has to live in silence because there are these mysterious aliens that hunt by sound. So any sound draws the aliens. Knowing that even the slightest whisper or footstep can bring death, Evelyn and Lee, those are the parents, are determined to find a way to protect their kids while desperately searching for a way to fight back. The very beginning of the film, this isn't really a spoiler, it's literally in the first 3 minutes of the film. They have a very young child. They are trying to walk into town to get food in this post-apocalyptic era, and the little kid basically gets eaten by an alien. So now, mom and dad have to decide, are they going to have more kids? And they do. They get pregnant. They decide to have the kid, despite the fact that it puts everybody at risk. There was some flack out there for Emily Blunt's character being with child in a horror apocalyptic setting, but those reactions miss the actual deeply profound nature of the story. The entire concept of the film is rooted in the risk that is going to take place in the last third of the film when mom actually has the baby.
Oh my God.
This is about the idea that even when you have a pretty good reason not to have a kid, you should still have a kid and take life-altering risk in order to have that kid. So unintentionally, the movie's incredibly pro-life. Okay, but that is not the only mainstream Hollywood film that has received all sorts of...
Wait, that's it! That's it! It's pro-life because after the apocalypse, they still want to have a kid.
Right.
So it's pro-life. And the message is, the conservative value is, even if you are going to risk your life, you need to have the child.
In fact, if the life of the mother had been in danger, they go, let her die. Let her die and let this child live. And a year from now, we'll get reinforcements and take back the planet.
Honestly, in a million years, I cannot figure out what is the supposed conservative value here. Like,
it's pro-life. Pro-life.
But he said already they made the choice.
Right.
That's all the thing is like, that's it. They made the choice to have the child. It's not like they were forced to not have a child. It was not like they were forced to have a child. They made the choice. They assessed the risks. That's not, it is, yes, it's pro-survival of the species.
Yeah.
It is, but it is not pro-life in the sense that it's forcing people to carry to term.
Right.
Pregnancy. That's absurd.
Well, also, I will say, though, that a left-wing value is screaming in a bathtub after a bad acid trip or something like that. So I do think, so the movie, they're trying to, on one level, appeal to the libs. I call them the libs. Appeal to the libs. But then secretly on another level, they're trying to show you that, I think that guy really has problems, Ben Shapiro. He's going crazy?
All right. This is, I will have to make an admission now.
You like him.
I know. I didn't watch any more of this video except for that part.
Oh, I watched the whole thing.
Okay, so I don't know what the next movie is, but let's play it. I couldn't. I saw that. I was like, oh my God, if the rest of this is anything like that, we got to do this with Andy. So let's.
Should we do the next movie or should we do like message at the end?
Well, let's do one more movie, then we'll do the message at the end.
Well, first of all, I'm learning. Thank God I'm learning about these secret values that I was previously not aware of.
Absolutely. It's about time.
Only mainstream Hollywood film that has received all sorts of critical plaudits and is actually pretty conservative. Hey, how about Soul? So Soul just came out. This is the new Jamie Foxx Pixar movie. The film is about a New York jazz pianist named Joe. He suddenly finds himself trapped in a strange land between Earth and the afterlife when he falls down a manhole and apparently dies. In trying to hold back his own death with whatever it takes, he ends up stumbling into the great before in a magical reinterpretation of life beyond Earth. There is a system where unborn souls exist. These unborn souls have value. They've existed well before childbirth.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
They're given a spark, which is a passion, as the final touch. And then they are placed into human bodies. Life exists both before and after life. And before a child is born, there is life. And before and after people die, there is life. These are extremely religious and conservative concepts. There's no way to watch Soul and go, okay, yeah. And then if you believe that the soul is implanted in the
pause it for 1 second. Now I want to confess I have not seen this movie yet. I imagine it sounds like a movie that Saul and I will be watching very shortly. But is it arguing that life exists through, like, what is the period in which you're alive called if it's all life? Isn't it saying that the spirit is alive eternally?
Right.
But what's the difference between that period of time when you're born and you die?
Yes.
Doesn't there have to be some distinguish?
Well, I think you're not getting the fact that Ben is not, he's not a scientist, or he's basically expressing the truth of things, even when he's saying horribly untrue things.
From science, I'm sacking it from his perspective, because if that interregnum period, when you are alive, is irrelevant to life, then I don't understand what the issue is in the first place.
Right. Well, I have to say, though, that when people use animated films in this way, it's pretty hard to argue with.
It's a little bit tricky, but aren't we talking about spirit? We're not talking about life.
No, yeah.
We're talking about soul or spirit. It's not life. It's literally can't be life. Then there is no non-life.
Is every one of these about like how the movies, the conservative actually means just pro-life?
I don't know.
Anything that has life in it.
It was rude for me to interrupt. All right, let's continue. That's good.
Body of the fetus from conception, which presumably is what's happening, that if you believe that's what's happening, that you should go ahead and have an abortion. It's a very pro-life film. People who have made it, I'm not sure.
Back it up. Wait. I need to see where he's going with this. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. And then if you believe that the soul is implanted.
Before that. Just a little bit more. Okay, right.
Value.
There.
They've existed well before childbirth.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
They're given a spark, a passion, as the final touch. And then they are placed into human bodies. Life exists both before and after life. And before a child is born, there is life. And before and after people die, there is life. These are extremely religious and conservative concepts. There's no way to watch soul and go, okay, yeah. And then if you believe that the soul is implanted in the body of the fetus from conception, which presumably is what's happening, that if you believe that's what's happening, that you should go ahead and have an abortion. It's a very pro-life film. People who have made it, I'm not sure realize that, but it just is. Arrival.
My favorite part. They don't even know. They don't even know that they're making a pro-life film.
I would have to say that if you believe that the soul and life exists before and after, before you're born and after you die, then what possible difference could it be?
Right. The soul even exists if someone decides to abort a fetus that they were based on rape. There's still life.
Forget about rape or danger of the like. The way that he is describing this, it almost seems like he's advocating, he's almost like pro murder, like out, like even after like, yeah. According to him, life is completely, the period in which you're born and die is completely irrelevant to your life.
Right.
And so therefore, why would there be even any type of inhibition about killing anybody? According to him.
Well, also in that movie, there is some, the way they pour out those souls, there is some, I spoke to a creationist and there is some truth to that, the way that's depicted in that movie.
They do kind of pour the soul into the soul, yes. And the soul gets implanted into the, I see. But I mean, if it doesn't, if there's no death, if death does not exist, I mean, I don't understand, like, what the issue is, even with murder, which I understand apparently is they're pro-life. I mean, I don't understand. How can you be anti-life if life exists eternally?
You know, the thing a lot about, see, it's a lot of things that Ben says, you can't allow the lacks in logic and the defects. You have to let it resonate with your heart. And his heart is to make as much money as he can off of right-wing racist people.
Okay, let's continue on. I can't believe how duped those makers of that movie were, though.
No, they don't even know.
They had no idea. All right,
we should go ahead and have an abortion. It's a very pro.
Where he sums it up, right? Is that it?
Yeah.
Is that where we want to go? He goes through some other movies, but I have no idea what they were because I couldn't.
I like when he looks down, knowing that he has absolutely doesn't have an idea in his head. He's kind of looking around his brain to see if he can find something.
Every movie that you see that has a hero overcoming obstacles, that is about a person who is acting with some form of durability and integrity in the world. And these are all conservative values. They do not hold up to
integrity.
World War II, like World War II.
Conservative values, durability and integrity.
It's like a freshman creative writing class where you're just doing free association.
It is. I mean, I would pay a significant amount of money to see, to like, you know, put this guy at like, you know, put some, I don't know if there's any truth serum out there to find out if he actually believes that like durability and integrity are conservative values as opposed to like their values, period.
Yeah, no.
Like, yeah, it wasn't durable for, let's say, union people to get their heads clubbed in and fight for a union. Or integrity is not walking away from a couple of bucks because you don't believe that the most important value is accumulation of money. That's not,
Yeah, and you remember how the libs wanted to walk away from Hitler? They said, forget it, everything's fine. The libs never want to, they never fight. The libs, I've looked at the libs value book, and it says that you should have no values. It says right in the libs book.
Classic lib value of disposability. But let's continue here. I'm curious what else is going to be a conservative value.
A person who is acting with some form of durability and integrity in the world. And these are all conservative values. They do not hold up to left-wing scrutiny. In fact, even the most left-wing films you've seen are built along these lines. Even ones that are overtly left-wing are built along the lines of there is some oppressor who is trying to stop the hero from being free, and now the hero must stand up for himself and or for somebody else. They have to stand up for somebody else. Now, there can be left-wing ideas that are pushed using this sort of conservative formula. You see this in film all the time. But if you're trying to tell an apolitical film, one that is openly left-wing, very often you'll see these sort of conservative messages seeping in. So to go back to the original examples, if you're looking at A Quiet Place, the challenge of this family is to survive and to propagate to the next generation.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. What he's saying is it's impossible to make a film with exclusively left-wing or progressive values because even the notion of storytelling in and of itself is
conservative. It's a conservative value. It is a conservative thing. I'm starting to see things more. He's Jewish, right? And I'm Jewish. So I'm beginning to feel a little mishpacha with him.
Right.
Can you believe? Here's the thing. I cannot believe. I was under the impression that I thought Reagan was the least communicative person. I couldn't believe that people thought this Reagan was a good communicator. And now we cut to this guy. I don't know why I think that this guy, even though he's an evil person, Ben Shapiro, who's just making money on racism and hate, I would think he'd be better. He's not even as good as Limbaugh.
I know what you're talking about. It is amazing.
No skill, zero skill.
The bar is pretty low in this instance. All it really takes is enough millions of dollars to advertise on Facebook. At a loss. Wasn't he doing that at one point? Like he spent, there was some release of how much money at one point he was spending or his outfit was spending on advertisements on Facebook. And it is now created. He is now consistently the number one linked to, link on Facebook. And I think it's because they spent millions of dollars on advertising to establish him. I mean, look, you see that. In the YouTube world, someone could build an audience, affiliated with, let's say, some big outfit. I don't know, like TYT. Like, for instance, if I had a TYT show, a Young Turk show, and I got, let's say, 700,000 subscribers, and then I stopped working with TYT and I went out on my own with that subscriber base, I'm not going to lose it. I've built on that. And that's what I feel like, on some way Shapiro did that, but with just the huge expenditure of cash. But let's continue on because I'm fascinated by this.
You have to protect them. Promise me. You will protect them.
If mom decided to have an abortion, she and dad are not the heroes anymore. She and dad are just victims of the situation. Right? If you go back to Arrival, if the heroine of the story knows that she is going to have a child, the child is going to suffer and die, but she decides not to go through with it, then she's no longer the heroine of the story. She's just somebody who's a victim of circumstance. It is the challenges in life that cause us to rise above the challenges in life, right? That is the power of the myth. That is the power of the story.
Oh my and gosh, Joseph Campbell.
Come back. There's this thing where he says, like, yeah, if you overcome obstacles, that's a conservative thing.
Yeah.
Even if you're
yes.
capitalist.
Right. Exactly.
No longer the heroine of the story. She's just somebody who's a victim of circumstance. It is the challenges in life that cause us to rise above the challenges in life, right? That is the power of the myth. That is the power of the story. And to do so with virtue. Right? So all of that has to be upheld in story structure. And that is why you see so many films that are purportedly left-wing that actually are not as left-wing as the creators would want them to be. And if they ever figured this out, then they would be a lot less insulting about conservatism, considering that virtually all of the hallmarks of the films that they make are rooted in conservative ideas about the world, about morality, about decency, and about self-control and free will. I want to know what you...
How, if you were, I'm sorry, I lost my thread.
So when Galileo said, hey, maybe we're not the center of everything, right? And the church basically said, we're going to lock you away for doing this. He was being very conservative, and they were being the libs.
I'm amazed that everything can break down into these categories. That's the thing.
Is correctly, how does that work? Overcoming stuff. Wait, what is it?
He always sneaks in stuff. He goes like, you know, and of course they're breathing and eating food, which is a conservative value, but they don't
mention it. It is the challenges in life that cause us to rise above the challenges in life, right? That is.
It is the challenges.
It's challenges of life.
Which cause us to rise above the challenges in life. I mean,
and that's conservatism.
That's
conservatism.
It is the case that there would be no opportunity to rise above the challenges in life. No challenges in life. And I guess that's hard to argue with, but to say that the rising above the challenges in the life is a function of the challenges in life, that seems to be...
Let me ask you a question. What if an alien invaded my wife's
The challenges
inside?
In life that cause us to rise above the challenges in life, right?
That's right. But what if an alien invaded my wife while she was pregnant? And he was the devil. He goes, I'm going to kill everybody. And then I'm going to kill this. Shouldn't I have the unborn fetus? And I made him a suicide fetus to stop the takeover from this alien. I didn't ask the alien to enter through my wife's fetus.
No.
So what do you want me to do, Sam? Should I bring the baby to term? Or should I have a suicide baby that also, I don't want to kill anyone, but the suicide baby will kill this horrible alien.
Oh my God.
Or do I have to tell the alien to get out of the bed, get out of the baby, get away from the baby?
I feel like Andy took like some mushrooms just before we started this segment, and now they're kicking in.
Which is a liberal value. But if I had mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, conservative.
Oh my God. Well, listen.
God bless him, right? God bless him.
Like, I wanted to come to some resolution for this segment, but I don't know how to do it, frankly.
Well, he's great. First of all, he's great. He's great. Love him, hate him, or hate him even more. This guy is entertaining. I like a guy who looks down into his hideous brain while he's talking. This guy is a conservative icon.
I think he wants to make movies, Andy.
He desperately wants to. He desperately. That's he desperately wants to.
Do you think Dave Rubin rolls his eyes at Shapiro?
That is. I wonder if they both walk away going, "Boy, that guy."
Well, but I mean, like Rubin's so hilarious because of his extensive comedy background. You've seen him with his soy jokes. That guy, he doesn't have to be selling his soul to make a living. He could be out in the clubs, Rubin.
All right. Well, Andy,
I love you.
I love you too, but maybe we should have the Andy Kindler theme song.
Let's Matt. Do it. Oh, that's my favorite part.
Matt is like, he's just, and he's using this whole excuse about having to sit at two different tables at the same time.
With a Jew like Andy Kindler.
This is going to be your outro song now. Home.
His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. A true Obama bot.
I didn't see that picture and of you as Elvis.
Obama
oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, and I can't laugh.
That's you as
.com.
No.
You made me laugh so
Andy.
Hard. I had to
break.
Let's
Andy Kindler.
Don't learn words to learn. Andy, always a pleasure.
I love you so much, Sam.
Love you, Andy. It was great.
And thank you, everybody. And right. I'll see you. I can't close week.
Going out? Are you touring? What are you doing?
Oh, don't forget to listen to my podcast, Thought Spiral. I'm not touring yet. I'll be performing locally, hence the humor still available. I may never go out again.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Well, Andy Kindler, if you do not go out anymore, we will bring people to you.
Please, oh, that would be good.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Okay. All right, folks. Let's head to the fun half. I'm going to do a brief fun half this 45 minutes. Not bad. What the heck is going on here? I gotta take a pair of scissors to my head again. Folks, it is your support that makes the show possible. When you become a member, you support the show at jointhemajorityreport.com. We are heading back into studio. We're, you know, rejiggering stuff a little bit. We're going to start, you know, it has been a tough year, obviously, for a myriad of reasons. But your support has, you know, is what really keeps us trucking along every day. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Subscribe or like, or, you know, let's get a hype train going. Come on, man, this poggers around here. Everybody, poggers. So let's do that. Also, don't forget our merch. I haven't gotten an update on the tank top yet. We'll get that update next week. My sister's out of town, so she follows that. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe of media?
There will be a twitch.tv/literatehangover stream sometime this weekend. I don't know if it'll be tonight or tomorrow, but subscribe over there if you want to see me stream Resident Evil Village.
And don't forget, folks, Nomi Show now 2 days a week. You can find that at The Nomi Key Show at, youtube.com/The Nomi Key Show and then twitch.tv/The_Nomi_Key_Show. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
You bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money.
A hell of a lot of bank.
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck 'em.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.